Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, good morning, everybody. We've been studying Sutta number 44 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is the Chula Veda Sutta. And though it's a short sutta, but the topics that it brings up are very deep and they often require a lot of explanation. So we've been going through it pretty slowly. Okay, so last time we completed the section on it was called Nirodha Samapatti, the attainment of the cessation of perception and feeling. And now we come to the section on feeling. This is on page 400, on the bottom of the page. Okay, so this section begins, this is, if you remember, it's a dialogue between the lay disciple named Visakha and the bhikkhuni, the Buddhist nun, Dhammadina, who had formerly been his wife when they were in lay life. Okay, so now Visakha asks Dhammadina a question about feelings. He asks, "Lady, how many kinds of feelings are there?" If you remember, we were speaking about Vedana, feeling. It's one of the five aggregates, one of the components of the five aggregates. And so now, the dialogue is going to focus in more finely upon feeling and then take the relationship between feelings and the defilements. Okay, so he asks, how many kinds of feelings are there? And she replies that there are these three kinds of feelings which have often been stated by the Buddha. That is pleasant feeling, painful feeling, and neither painful nor pleasant feeling. And remember that the word that's translated as feeling, Vedana, doesn't mean something like emotions, the way the word feeling often does in English, but it refers specifically and exclusively to what I call the felt tone of an experience, or might call it the affective tone of an experience. And so according to its felt tone, its experienced tone, a feeling can be either pleasant or agreeable, painful or disagreeable. And then when it's neither one nor the other, it's called neither painful nor pleasant feeling. Okay, so now Visakha asks another question. He asks, what is pleasant feeling? What is painful feeling? What is neither painful nor pleasant feeling? Really, feeling is something very difficult to explain unless one feels it. You know, you can't, it's like trying to convey the taste of a durian to somebody who's never tasted one. Or the taste, you make a face. Or the taste of a, maybe durian is too strange a taste. Taste of a mango fruit or a mango. To a Westerner who's never had access to markets that carry Asian fruits, or a custard apple, who knows the taste of a custard apple? Nobody. Well, yeah, it's a very delicious fruit that we have in Sri Lanka. It's big. You break it open and it doesn't look like any fruits that are familiar to me in the West. But it has a texture, very soft texture, a little bit like custard. Yeah. And the taste is like custard also, but it's a fruit. Jackfruit? Do you know jackfruit? You do know jackfruit. Okay, so Dhammadina is answering. So whatever is felt bodily or mentally as pleasant and soothing is pleasant feeling. So in a way, this answer is almost, we call it tautological, in which the answer includes the terms of the questions. But she's not trying to give a logical definition, but just to convey a sense of what pleasant feeling is. So it's whatever is felt as pleasant and soothing or pleasant and agreeable. And notice that it's being subdivided into two kinds of feelings. Can be a bodily feeling, a sensation in the body, or it can be a mental feeling. This is something that the feeling that we usually accompany an emotional state. Okay, then painful feeling, whatever is felt bodily or mentally as painful and hurting, or painful and disagreeable, is painful feeling. So again, the explanation repeats the term of the question, but again it breaks it up into two kinds, bodily and mental feeling. Okay, and then whatever is felt bodily or mentally that is neither soothing nor hurting, neither pleasant nor painful, that is neither painful nor pleasant feeling. So we have these three feelings. They're all described as in terms of whether they're pleasant, painful, soothing, or hurting. Okay, now we come to another question. This sounds a little paradoxical rather than tautological. Okay, what is pleasant and what is painful in regard to pleasant feeling? What is painful and what is pleasant in regard to painful feeling? And what is pleasant and what is painful in regard to neither painful nor pleasant feeling? Okay, and then she answers, pleasant feeling is pleasant when it persists. As long as the pleasant feeling endures, then we experience it as pleasant. But the pleasant feeling becomes painful when it changes. In a way, actually speaking strictly, the pleasant feeling doesn't turn into pain. A pleasant feeling is always pleasant, a painful feeling is always painful. But what happens when a pleasant feeling comes to an end, then we experience unhappiness or sorrow or some kind of sadness. So when the pleasant feeling disappears, when we become attached to a pleasant feeling, we want it to last, we're relishing it, delighting in it, and then it changes, or the conditions for that pleasant feeling change, then pain arises. Okay, then painful feeling is painful when it persists. That is, as long as it continues, the painful feeling, naturally, it's painful. But it's pleasant when it changes. So when that painful feeling disappears, it doesn't actually turn into pleasure or pleasant feeling, but the pain, the stopping of the pain, gives rise to pleasure. Do we have any dentists in the room? or anybody who's gone to a dentist in the room. Now, when the dentist is digging deep into a cavity with his drill, you know, when you're going about your day-to-day activities, you never notice the teeth at all. But if you go to the dentist on a routine visit, he discovers a cavity, he starts to drill, then while the drill is going on, the drilling, oh, it's so painful. And then you're just hoping, any second, then boom, the drill comes to an end. And then you're back to your normal state, everyday state, but what arises in the mind? What kind of feeling when the sound of the drill stops, the pressure of the drill stops? What arises?
Relief.
What?
Relief.
Relief, but in terms of feeling?
Pleasant
feeling, right? Or if the weather is very, very cold one day after another, and you always have to go out, maybe to work, maybe walking some distance, to go walk up to the dining room to take the meal, and then every day you're going out and you have to go through this extremely biting cold weather, then after maybe a few weeks the weather starts to warm up and becomes mild, then when you go out, what do you feel? What? You step out on that first day of spring. Yeah, pleasant feeling. Then when the spring advances and the temperature gets hotter, hotter, hotter until you get to the first hot spell, then the pleasant feeling changes and it becomes painful. Okay, so these two are fairly easy to understand. But then comes a third one. Neither painful nor pleasant feeling is pleasant when there is knowledge of it, when it's known, and painful when there is no knowledge of it. How do you think we should understand this? It's not so clear to me.
It seems to me that boredom is excruciating if you're not aware that you're bored.
Yeah.
And boredom is sort of that state of in between. You know, nothing really exciting and pleasant is happening, but nothing really unpleasant
is happening. Yeah. But what happens if you know that you're bored?
Well, I don't know. It can get interesting.
It can get interesting. That's a good point, actually. You know, this happens in meditation. In fact, it's one of the ways to overcome boredom in meditation. I think very often the meditation becomes boring, you know, especially you have to do just observing the breath in and out, or the rising and falling of the abdomen, rising, falling. And so if you're doing this day after day, and so it can get boring. Because in a way, you're not aware of the boredom itself. But then, what you can do if a sense of boredom comes, is just put the boredom under observation, and just look into the state of mind that's feeling bored, and just observe, what is boredom? And just keep on looking, trying to look at each moment of boredom as it's arising. And then it becomes very interesting, and the boredom disappears. Anybody else have any thoughts about this?
I think for myself, before I did the practice, there was only the word of pleasant and the unpleasant.
Maybe if somebody could pass this microphone back.
Um, Before I was practicing, I felt very strongly that there was just a world of pleasant and the unpleasant, and there was no understanding even of the neutral.
Yeah.
So at that point, life is just one grasping after the other.
Yeah.
And so, in my experience, the neutral actually came in after I started to practice.
Mm.
And I see that in my children, that for them, it's just either pleasant or unpleasant.
Oh, but there is the neutral feeling for everybody.
I don't think they're aware of it. I think that's something that has to be taught.
Yeah, one tends to pass over the feeling that's neither painful nor pleasant, because generally one wants to experience pleasure, and so and so that even that experience that's neither pleasant nor painful, because one is not getting pleasure out of it, it's not that one recognizes it as painful, but it just becomes like an oppressive sense of the absence of pleasure.
Right.
And so then one has to switch over and find something exciting, something tantalizing, something stimulating, arousing, something that will churn up the mind. Anybody else have any ideas about this?
I wonder, I think it's something like when you're on a cell phone and you're multitasking, and suddenly you're not multitasking, but you need to. You do keep on doing things, and you feel this restlessness to be stimulated by something, but you aren't. So that may be you're in the neutral state, but want not to be in the neutral state.
Yeah, I think this is another example of it, that especially prominent nowadays, maybe not so much in the Buddha's time, but we always have to keep busy, engaged, excited, involved. And if that we settle back into a moment of stillness where there's nothing exciting going on, though we can relish it, if we know how to relish that stillness, then it becomes pleasant. But if we don't, then it becomes something which is uncomfortable. One feels uncomfortable with that stillness and has to turn away from it into something which is exciting and stimulating. Okay, anyway, I think that there's a whole range of experiences that are neither pleasant nor painful that we can see. If we know that state, it can become pleasant. If we don't know it, it's not actually felt as pain, but because it's the absence of pleasure, it's oppressive or uncomfortable. Did you have something to add?
I have a question, because I always had a problem with this neither painful nor pleasant feeling. If you're aware of it, it's pleasant. Not aware of it, it's painful.
Yeah.
Isn't it itself a pleasant feeling?
I think in itself it has to be judged as a neither, or classified as a neither pleasant nor a neither painful nor pleasant feeling. But just, it takes on these qualities of being, you could say, pleasant or painful, maybe in relation to another feeling, like perhaps in relation to painful feeling, the neither pleasant nor painful feeling can be considered pleasant. Like again, to go back to the example of the patient under the drill of the dentist. So because he's undergoing pain, when the pain stops, he's back to his everyday experience of the teeth, which is nothing. We don't really experience the teeth unless we have a toothache. But that ordinary experience of the teeth is now felt as pleasant, or can be considered pleasant, because the pain is stopped. And then somebody who's experiencing an intense pleasure, when that pleasure stops and they go back to the ordinary feeling, that ordinary neutral feeling becomes painful because of the absence of pleasure. Yes, David?
this seems to, in addition to the definitions here, there's also an issue of impermanence, how things change.
Yeah.
Right. So is that what the underlying issue of all of this is about, that feelings are not permanent, that they change as one watches them?
And that's a very good point, very good point. Yeah, definitely that is the sort of the underlying premise or presupposition.
So it relates to the notion of self and the lack of self, because there is no permanence.
Yeah, so he's not bringing that in. They're not bringing that in. But they're just dealing with the fact that feelings change, and so in the change of feelings we could see how they seem to take on characteristics which are different from their intrinsic characteristic, because of the relativity of the experience of feeling.
I have a question. Is this a better way to live, like a leader?
Please put the microphone closer.
Is this a better way to live, like every day, like neither painful or nor pleasant life? If when you feel like happiness, pleasant, probably just a shorter time of pleasant. After that, probably you don't feel it.
Probably.
You know, after you feel the pleasant time, then when the pleasant is over, then you don't feel any pleasant.
Yeah.
And when you have a pain, painful feeling, after painful, you don't feel the pain.
Yeah.
So is it a better way to live, like neither painful or nor a pleasant life? Is a better way to live every day?
Generally, we don't have a control or mastery over this. Of course, certain types of pursuing certain types of pleasure, we can avoid those if they cause disturbance in the mind. We can avoid certain situations that bring pain. But we're not able just to put ourselves into a state which is neither pleasant nor painful all the time. It's inevitable, just as long as we live, that we meet with pleasant and painful feelings too. But I think we're going to come to the implications of that in the next section of the sutta.
The word present, the original part of the word is sukha or pity.
So this is sukha.
Sukha.
Yeah.
And painful, this is dukkha.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a good point. I'm not sure if it's dealt with later in the sutta. Okay, now there's... The question is, if one puts oneself into a state of equanimity, does that help one deal with both pleasure and pain? Is that the question? Yeah. Now there's a distinct state which is called equanimity, upeka, which is not the same as neither pleasant nor painful feeling. But upeka we could call balance of mind or composure of mind. And so it's possible to develop equanimity. And when one develops equanimity, then even though one meets with pleasant feeling, one is not drawn towards it or sucked into it, or one doesn't become addicted to it. And even though one meets with painful feeling, though one undergoes the pain, but it doesn't pull one down and cause one to become feeling oppressed, afflicted, overwhelmed. But one is able to look on with a balanced mind, no matter what one feels, in the sense that it's one of the aims of Buddhist mind training, is to develop that equanimity under all conditions.
Is equanimity in meditation is what you're talking about, but is equanimity the same as detachment? Detaching oneself from one's feeling, becoming disconnected in a way.
This is a matter of the way we use these terms. And I'd say from the use of Buddhist technical terminology, equanimity and detachment are not quite identical. There's a certain maybe affiliation between them. Let us say detachment is the ability to experience the feeling without being attached, especially without being attached to the pleasant feeling.
To be able to observe it.
The ability to observe is closer to equanimity. But the two are affiliated, but not quite identical. Yes, please.
This reminds me of the story of the farmer and the son.
Oh, yeah, this is Zhuangzi's.
It is what it is.
Do you know this? Do you remember the story?
Yeah, I think I do.
Then if you want to tell it,
the farmer loses his horse one day, and the people in the town come to him and say, "Oh, that's so unfortunate, you've lost your horse, how will you plow your fields? This is terrible." And the farmer says, "I don't know if this is good or bad, all I know is that my horse is gone." And the next day, I think the horse comes back with a whole...
Yeah. A herd of horses.
And the townspeople say, "Oh, this is so wonderful. Now you'll be wealthy, you'll have more, you know, work power and so forth." And the farmer says, "I don't know if this is good or bad. All I know is that many horses have come to me." And the next day, the son goes out and he tries to break one of the stallions and he falls off the horse and is pretty badly hurt. And the townspeople come rushing to him and say, "Oh, this is so awful. How are you going to plow? How are you going to work? You're missing your son. You're by yourself. This, you know." And the farmer says, "I don't know if this is good or bad. All I know is that my son is hurt."
Yeah.
The following day, an army comes through and recruits all of the able-bodied young men. And the son, you know, obviously can't go, and you know, so on and so forth. So I guess the whole premise behind it is that it is what it is, and to become attached to a particular emotion and follow through with that emotion to all sorts of things is really a waste of time.
Okay, I think we should go on because I want to finish the sutta today. Okay, so now we come to the next section. This is the very important section. It's on what is called here the underlying tendencies. In Pali, this is the word anusaya. Yeah, the word anusaya, it comes from the verb anusaiti, which is made up of the prefix anu, which means along with, and saiti means to lie down. And so the anusayas are certain mental tendencies which lie down, metaphorically speaking, they lie down along with the current of the mind. And so there are dispositions, tendencies that are somehow always present in the mind, dormantly, but then under the appropriate kind of stimulus, they come rising up to the surface and become active. And so there are three primary underlying tendencies. One is called raga anusaya. This is the underlying tendency to lust, or maybe that's too strong, the underlying tendency to attachment, or the underlying tendency to enjoyment. The second is the underlying tendency to aversion. And the third is the underlying tendency to ignorance. And so the underlying tendency to lust, that is the tendency to become attached to certain experiences or to cling to certain experiences and to try to sap whatever pleasure we can out of them. The underlying tendency to aversion is the tendency to dislike, to push away, to evade certain experiences or to deny certain experiences. And then the underlying tendency to ignorance is not knowing or not understanding. And these three anusyas are seen as having a particularly close connection with certain types of feelings. And so this is what is brought up in this section of the sutta. The lay disciple Visakha asks Dhammadina, what underlying tendency underlies pleasant feeling? What is the underlying tendency that is connected with pleasant feeling and that springs up in response to pleasant feelings? What underlying tendency underlies painful feeling? What is it that painful feeling provokes and brings into activity? And what underlying tendency underlies neither painful nor pleasant feeling? What is that underlying tendency that comes into being when there is this neutral state of feeling? Okay, and then Dhammadina responds, the underlying tendency to lust or attachment underlies pleasant feeling. So pleasant feeling triggers off or arouses, provokes, activates the underlying tendency to attachment. The underlying tendency to aversion underlies painful feeling. So painful feeling triggers, provokes, activates aversion. And then the underlying tendency to ignorance underlies neither painful nor pleasant feeling. When neither painful nor pleasant feeling is occurring, then the general tendency is to remain in the state of this, maybe we call it a dull apathy or a dull complacency, which is a state of ignorance, not recognizing the real nature of things. Okay, but then the question comes up, which is brought up next. Does the underlying tendency to lust or attachment underlie all pleasant feeling? Does the underlying tendency to aversion underlie all painful feeling? Does the underlying tendency to ignorance underlie all neither painful nor pleasant feeling? If the answer to this were yes, then, in a sense, we would have to be like victims of our feelings forever. Whenever we felt any kind of pleasure, automatically and spontaneously, attachment would arise. We would have no choice, no control over it. Whenever we felt any kind of pain, then the underlying tendency to aversion would arise, and we'd be bound by that. And in our ordinary day-to-day state, which is neither pleasant nor painful, we would always be just drifting along in a state of ignorance. Okay, but Bhikkhuni Dhammadina answers in the negative that these three underlying tendencies don't underlie or don't become activated by the three corresponding types of feeling. Okay, then we come to question number, in paragraph number 27. What should be abandoned in regard to pleasant feeling? What should be abandoned in regard to painful feeling? What should be abandoned in regard to neither painful nor pleasant feeling? Okay, now this is a question, or these questions sort of point us in the direction of the process of mental training in Buddhism. How do we train the mind since we're always being subjected to these feelings? So she asks, the underlying tendency to lust or attachment should be abandoned in regard to pleasant feeling. In other words, inevitably we experience pleasant feelings, but we have to train ourselves so that these pleasant feelings will not spontaneously and instantaneously provoke or activate that underlying tendency to attachment. One should be able to experience pleasant feeling without grasping onto it and hold clinging to it. The underlying tendency to aversion should be abandoned in regard to painful feeling. So even though we experience painful feelings, we should be able to pass through them without being overwhelmed by aversion, dislike, discontent towards those feelings. And the underlying tendency to ignorance should be abandoned in regard to neither painful nor pleasant feeling. In other words, when we experience this neither painful nor pleasant feeling, we have to be able to arouse knowledge, insight, or wisdom into that insight into that feeling. Okay, so this text is saying that it's possible to abandon the three underlying tendencies in regard to the three feelings, and that is the way that one should train oneself. Okay, but now the question comes up, does the underlying tendency to lust have to be abandoned in regard to all pleasant feeling? Does the underlying tendency to aversion have to be abandoned in regard to all painful feeling? Does the underlying tendency to ignorance have to be abandoned in regard to all feeling that's neither painful nor pleasant? Okay, then she answers that this is not the case, that the underlying tendency to lust doesn't have to be abandoned in regard to all pleasant feeling, the underlying tendency to aversion doesn't have to be abandoned in regard to all painful feeling, the underlying tendency to ignorance doesn't have to be abandoned in regard to all neither painful nor pleasant feeling. Now, this doesn't mean that one could allow the underlying tendencies to lust, aversion, and ignorance to continue. But rather what it's saying is that there is, or at least this seems to me to be the implication of the passage, that there are certain feelings that are pleasant, painful, and neutral, that are wholesome, that are beneficial, and so one can arouse those kinds of feelings, even though there is a real danger that the underlying tendencies can be provoked by those feelings. But it's simply not the case that one has to avoid these feelings because they're connected with the underlying tendencies. This is the way I understand it. Okay, now she goes on to elaborate, and I think you'll see my point in the elaboration. Okay, first she takes the case of here, a monk who secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states of mind, enters and dwells in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. Okay, now the first jhana, this is the first state of meditative absorption, or the first state of deep samadhi, where the mind becomes focused one-pointedly on the object, sustained, the attention is sustained on that object, so that all of the disturbing, distracting factors of the mind are pushed away, and the mind enters into this deep, rapturous, and blissful meditative state of absorption. Okay, so this is a state of pleasure which is far superior to any of the pleasures of the senses. And so there is, in regard to this pleasure, the underlying tendency to attachment can arise in regard to that state. There is that possibility. And so some people can become attached to the first, who attained the first jhana, can become attached to it and cling to it. So that's a real possibility. But she is saying that it's possible to achieve that state and then one abandons the attachment to it. And when one abandons the attachment to it, then the underlying tendency to lust does not underlie that feeling. Okay, so this seems to be the point, at least the way I understand it. So here, the meditator attains the first jhana. It usually requires a high degree of skill and persistent practice to achieve that state. But once attaining the first jhana, then as long as the mind has not yet become fully developed in the practice of the first jhana, one will tend to cling to it. So it's natural for the underlying tendency to lust or attachment to arise in regard to the first jhana. But after achieving the first jhana, then one abandons that attachment to it. Just by the force of the will, one avoids clinging to it or attaching to it, and then the underlying tendency to lust does not underlie that. So when it's possible to master that state in such a way that one doesn't become attached to it. So one can enter it when one wants to, one can stay in it as long as one wants to, one can be cut out of it and return to the normal state of mind, but without becoming attached to it. And so generally we could say in regard to, there's a distinction between wholesome pleasures and unwholesome pleasures. And so what Buddhism teaches is first one uses the wholesome pleasure as a way to overcome the unwholesome pleasure. Since the mind naturally we seek pleasure, and so one should try to cultivate and pursue the wholesome pleasures to avoid the unwholesome pleasures. Then when one experiences the wholesome pleasure, there's a tendency to latch on to it, to cling to it, but then one has to train oneself through effort, through understanding, particularly through insight into its impermanence, that one shouldn't cling even to the wholesome pleasure. And then one gradually abandons that attachment to it. Okay, then we come to the next section. Here it's regard to the painful feeling. So how does one abandon the underlying tendency to aversion in regard to painful feeling? And now the Dhammadina takes the case of a monk who perhaps isn't so successful in entering into these deep states of meditation. And so he thinks to himself, when shall I enter upon and abide in that base or that state that the noble ones now enter and abide in? So it's somebody who is longing to be able to enter into the higher meditative states or the states of liberation, particularly maybe the state of supreme liberation. And so he generates this longing or aspiration for it. And because of his inability at present to attain that state, then a feeling of displeasure arises, or what's called grief. So grief arises with that longing as condition. So this isn't what's called grief here, or a state of dejection. Is a state of painful feeling. It's a state of painful feeling that arises from an aspiration for what is good and noble. Okay, and then the text says, with that, he abandons aversion, and the underlying tendency to aversion does not underlie that. Okay, so he uses this grief or this dejection as a kind of spur to his own spiritual cultivation without becoming upset and overwhelmed by that feeling of grief or longing, but continues to cultivate and to practice patiently and persistently. And then through cultivation, one reaches a point where one overcomes that tendency to aversion. This is the way I would understand it. Maybe does anybody else have any idea about this? I'm just explaining my own way of seeing this. It's nothing authoritative. Do you have any ideas, Venerable Kemaratta? Is there a question on that? You have a question.
In the scheme of five aggregates, which aggregate does the underlying tendency belong to?
What's interesting in the suttas, one doesn't find an attempt to classify the underlying tendencies. But what happens in the later development of Buddhism, the aggregate of the sankharas, the volitional activities, is treated as a kind of umbrella category for putting all of the unwholesome and wholesome mental tendencies. And so they would come under the aggregate of the volitional activities, the sankharas.
Okay, if that's the case, then I think my understanding is that feeling, the impermanence of feelings is something that does not disappear as long as we have five aggregates. Even for a noble one, one will have pleasant feeling and painful feeling, and they are bound to change, neither painful nor pleasant, bound to change.
Yeah.
However, when the feeling occurs, we do have control over whether we abandon or attach to, say, underlying tendencies or other objects.
Yeah.
And that is a volitional force. So you basically use one volitional force to change another volitional force. So it's a force of karma.
Yeah.
That's my understanding.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point, yeah. It's through the mental factor of volition that belongs to the aggregate of volitional activities that one trains oneself to deal with these ever-changing feelings in such a way that one is not trapped in the underlying tendencies.
Okay. Will you be right to say a noble one still may have bodily painful feeling, but it will not affect the mind? So mind, there should not be any painful mind feeling.
Yeah, that's an important point. Maybe it depends on how you understand noble one. A stream enterer can have both. They can even be upset in the mind. But the arahat, the one who's completed the practice of the path, won't have any more mental painful feelings in the sense of sadness, grief, dejection, sorrow. But they'll still, as long as the body exists, they'll experience painful bodily feeling. That's inescapable.
How about compassion? What if they feel compassion?
Yeah.
Or empathy?
Yeah, well, compassion is being able to, in a sense, feel the suffering of others in the sense of identifying with them and not knowing what they feel and feeling that wish that others who are undergoing suffering will be free from the painful feelings, free from pain and misery. But it doesn't mean that the one who is generating compassion that his own mind will be oppressed by pain, sorrow, and grief. Because compassion is actually, it's a liberating state rather than a binding state. Okay, let us just go now to the last part of this section. Okay, now this is going to take the case of the fourth jhana, the fourth meditative absorption. So with the abandoning of pleasure and pain, and with the previous disappearance of joy and grief, the monk enters and dwells in the fourth jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure, so neither painful nor pleasant feeling, and it has purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. With that, he abandons ignorance, and the underlying tendency to ignorance does not underlie that. Okay, so now takes the case, the monk enters the fourth jhana, which has neither pleasant nor painful feeling. Okay, it's possible to enter into that state and still have the basic ignorance of it underlying it, in that one doesn't really understand that state in terms of its basic characteristics. So one can enter into the jhana, and it's a very peaceful, very equanimous state, and one can come out, and the underlying tendency to ignorance can still be present and still be activated by that state, because one is not directing the mind to understand it. But this passage is taking the case of the monk who develops the fourth jhana, and then based on the fourth jhana, develops insight or wisdom. And so he sees into the nature of the jhana and into the nature of all conditioned experience, and then abandons ignorance. And so now there's no more ignorance in regard to the fourth jhana. Okay, maybe this is a bit of high outside of our ordinary experience, but it's just, well, explaining how ignorance is abandoned. If there's any questions here, please, let's take them.
Ignorance of what?
I think this would be ignorance in the sense of not knowing the true characteristics of phenomena, what would be impermanence, dukkha, and non-self.
Well, would it be like ignorance of the Four Noble Truths?
Yeah. Ignorance of dependent origination, of the conditioned nature of the experience, and ignorance of the Four Noble Truths. Okay, Nina?
Earlier you said that we train ourselves to experience, and you know, the pleasant, unpleasant, and the neutral. And for the neutral, you had mentioned to arouse knowledge and wisdom. And I'm not quite sure if I really understand how that works. I mean, for me, the only thing I've ever, for me so far, understood is just to be aware of the neutral. So what does it mean to arouse knowledge and wisdom?
Well, here I think he's probably, well, she is probably referring to, you mean by abandoning ignorance? It's probably, as I answered David's question, it's to arouse insight into the three characteristics, into the conditioned nature of the experience, and then insight into the Four Noble Truths. Yeah.
But when you experience a neutral state,
yeah,
at that time, wouldn't you just, from moment to moment, just watch the process?
Yeah, that would be an elementary stage in sort of developing knowledge or insight. But here he's speaking, or she's speaking, about the abandoning of ignorance. So this implies that those momentary insights have been consolidated to the point where a complete or penetrating knowledge has arisen. But this is referring to...
But that one sees in the, for instance, in not just feeling, just the beginning, middle, and end of the observation of everything, that things are impermanent.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Right? So it's not just limited to the neutral state.
Oh, no. But it's just that neutral state is a state which tends to support and nourish and sustain that ignorance, because it doesn't have a distinctive, pleasant tone which would stimulate the attachment, or a distinct, painful tone which would stimulate the aversion. And so in that state of neutral feeling, that's sort of the ground where ignorance thrives, and where we could see it isolated from the underlying attachment and the underlying aversion.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, one more point then. I think I want to go back and try to finish the sutta.
Just this question. This all seems to be directed towards increasing self-awareness.
Is that
correct?
Yeah.
And the purpose of increasing self-awareness is so that we can let go of it.
Yeah.
Right? So... Yeah. No more so that you can let go of the whole thing. You can let go of feeling and the experience.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Well, I think the next section is going to deal with that kind of issue. Let me just see if there's any relevant questions from the internet. Because I want to finish the sutta. I have to finish it today. Would you say that a majority of most of our experience is neither pleasant nor painful, but our nature is such that we don't tolerate this absence of feeling, and so we almost instantaneously look for pleasure or create pain in the mind, which is why we rarely recognize the neutral feeling? Yeah, I think that's what I said before. Though usually we don't try to create pain for ourselves. Actually, many people do. But usually we try to create pleasure, we look for pleasure, and in the process we create pain for ourselves. Please elaborate on the sentence about having knowledge or no knowledge of neither painful nor pleasant feeling. Does knowledge here mean awareness or insight? I think I covered this pretty much in response to other questions. Third paragraph of 28, perhaps here lust does not refer to craving for the joy of the jhana, but the lust for the five sensory pleasures, or reading otherwise would dissuade the yogi from developing jhana. Actually, that's a good point. Let me just take another look at that. I mean, that's also a good interpretation, yeah. One develops the first jhana, and then by acquiring that access to the pleasure and bliss of the first jhana, then one loses the interest in the pleasure from the five senses. That's a good interpretation. And then this is just a continuation of that question. Okay, then how does the grief from the longing for liberation help to abandon aversion? Well, what I would say is that it's the longing for liberation which is actually giving rise to grief, but it's and then that grief naturally usually brings up aversion. But in this case, because of the longing for liberation, then one makes the patient, the persistent effort to develop the factors of the path. Then when one does so, then one overcomes aversion, one attains one's goal. And so then one no longer experiences that grief from not attaining it, and then one abandons that aversion that comes along with the grief. Okay, I think we have to go on so that we can take the last part of the sutta. Okay, now here is going to take another shift in the style of presentation, and this is going to be a series of questions and answers on what are called counterparts. The Pali word that's rendered as counterpart has actually two nuances. The word is, in Pali, it's patibhaga. The word bhaga can mean a portion, a section, a division. And the prefix pati has two senses. One is a sense of opposition. So two things that are opposites or opposed to one another. Well, opposites are opposed to one another. Two things that are opposites or are called patibhaga, counterparts. But the prefix pati can also suggest going beyond in a kind of succession or sequence. Like we have patipatta, the path or practice. It's taking steps that go one after another that bring one closer to the goal. And so here, counterpart are not things that are opposed to each other, but things that bring one from a lower stage to a higher stage. Okay, so both meanings will enter into this discussion. Okay, so first, Visakha asks, what is the counterpart of pleasant feeling? And Dhammadina says, painful feeling is the counterpart of pleasant feeling. What kind of counterpart is this of the two? Yeah, the two things that are opposites. Then what is the counterpart of painful feeling? The counterpart of painful feeling is pleasant feeling. So again, opposition. Okay, what is the counterpart of neither painful nor pleasant feeling? Okay, here, ignorance is the counterpart of neither painful nor pleasant feeling. Here, ignorance is the counterpart. It's not quite a sense of opposition, and also it's not quite the sense of going beyond, but let's say neither painful nor pleasant feeling and ignorance are counterparts, and that there are two things that tend to be bound to each other. Like, neither pleasant nor painful feeling is the kind of, maybe we call it the breeding ground of ignorance. And ignorance is what covers up the neither painful nor pleasant feeling so that we don't see it for what it really is. Okay, so now ignorance is introduced into the discussion. And then the question comes, what is the counterpart of ignorance? And so the counterpart of ignorance is vijaya, which means true knowledge, not intellectual knowledge, but this is experiential knowledge or true realization. And so now we're back into the counterparts as opposites, ignorance and true knowledge, true realization. Okay, now what is the counterpart of true knowledge? And then the counterpart of true knowledge is deliverance, or liberation. So this is the counterpart in the sense of one thing that goes beyond another. So first, like in the process of cultivation, at the peak or culmination of the practice, true knowledge arises, true realization. And then through that true realization, the mind is liberated from all of the fetters, the defilements, the unwholesome qualities. And so liberation is the counterpart of true knowledge. It's what lies on the other side of true knowledge. Okay, and then he asks, what is the counterpart of deliverance or liberation? And then she answers, Nibbana is the counterpart of liberation. Okay, this is getting pretty difficult now. The way I understand it, here liberation is referring not so much to the continued state of the liberated person, but rather to what I would call the event of liberation, to the experience of having the mind liberated from the defilements, released from the defilements, and that liberates one into the state of Nibbana, the experience of Nibbana. Okay, and then he asks the next question, what is the counterpart of Nibbana? So he's sort of expecting or pushing for something beyond Nibbana, higher than Nibbana. And now Dhammadina stops him and says, friend Visakha, you have pushed this line of questioning too far. You weren't able to grasp the limit to questions. For this holy life, or this spiritual path, is grounded upon Nibbana. It culminates in Nibbana. It ends in Nibbana. Actually, that should be really the end of her answer. And so Nibbana is the final goal of the whole spiritual path. And so if he's asking what is the counterpart of Nibbana, in the sense of what is there beyond Nibbana, there's really nothing beyond Nibbana. That is the final goal. Of course, she could have gotten out of this by using the counterpart as opposites and said samsara is the opposite of, is the counterpart of Nibbana. But already he was going in the direction of what lies beyond. We go from true knowledge to liberation, then from liberation, what lies beyond liberation, Nibbana, then what lies beyond Nibbana, and then she says, there's nothing beyond Nibbana. You've missed the drift of your own questions. Okay, so she answers in this way, and then she says, you know, if he's not satisfied with her answer, maybe he thinks that she has not realized something that should be realized, so she wants him to check out with the Buddha himself. So she says, if you want, friend Visakha, go to the Blessed One and ask him about this, and as he explains it to you, it's in that way that you should retain it in mind. Okay, so then the lay follower Visakha goes to the Buddha, and then he repeats his entire conversation with the Bhikkhuni Dhammadina. So he didn't just ask this question, but he explained the whole discussion, the whole conversation. And then when he finished speaking, then the Buddha says, the Bhikkhuni Dhammadina is wise. She has great wisdom. If you had asked me the meaning of this, I would have explained it to you in the same way that she explained it. That is the meaning, and so you should remember it. Okay, that is what the Blessed One said, and the lay follower of Visakha was satisfied and delighted in the Buddha's words. Okay, any questions? What's the real counterpart of Nibbana?
My question is, I think I was reading in a book by Thich Nhat Hanh this week, that is it possible that there are four Vedanas in other traditions? Because I think in this book he talks about feeling that it's painful and pleasant at the same time.
You know, I think strictly speaking, you know, looking at it from what we might call a moment-to-moment perspective on feeling. I'd say that that is not the case, probably. But sometimes there are feelings that, because the feelings are passing very, very quickly, so there are certain experiences where pleasant and painful feelings will succeed one another in rapid succession. And so when one looks at the experience from, I call it a macroscopic perspective, one could say that it's a feeling in which there's both pleasant and pain at the same time. But probably speaking from, you know, the microscopic perspective on feeling, it's not the case. Like sometimes, well, to give an example, one might see a very beautiful sunset, or even a striking piece of scenery, or one might have a memory of something that happened in the past in which there was both a mixture of joy and sorrow. And so sometimes we call this bittersweet memories. There's sweetness and bitterness mixed together. And so the bittersweet experience, it's an experience that combines elements of pleasure and elements of pain in terms of feeling. But when we look at that in terms of actual mind moments, probably it's not the case that at the level of mind moments there's a pleasant feeling and a painful feeling exactly occurring at the same moment. Let's see. Richard.
I think there's an equivocation on counterpart in this passage. Says it really seems to mean three different things.
Yeah.
Because in the first counterparts are, you know, pleasant feeling and painful feeling. Well, they're clearly opposites,
yeah.
Right? Then you have painful feeling and pleasant feeling, same opposites.
Yeah.
But the next one, a counterpart of neither painful nor pleasant feeling,
yeah,
is the same as the underlying tendency.
Yeah.
Right? Which is not the meaning that you have for the first two.
Yeah.
If you wanted to have the first two do that, then you'd say lust and aversion.
Yeah.
For the, if underlying tendency were a synonym for counterpart, you would have a very different answer.
Yeah.
Then again, it changes when you get to true knowledge and deliverance.
Yeah.
Because it's neither the meaning of the underlying tendency nor the meaning of opposition. Instead, these are in agreement, right? They're on the same side. So there seem to be three meanings for this term.
Yeah, I said basically that the meaning pattibhaga. I said that the word pattibhaga has two basic meanings.
Yeah.
The one basic meaning is that of opposition between two ideas, two concepts. The other meaning is one going beyond or continuing a particular sequence to the next stage. So those are the two dominant patterns of pattibhaga in this passage. But the one case, that of the relationship between neither pleasant or painful feeling and ignorance, doesn't fit into either of those models. So that is what I would call their counterparts in the sense of two things which are bound together in a close relationship, but it's not one of either opposition or succession.
Right. Well, since there are different meanings for that term, I can see why Vasaka is dissatisfied. Now,
well, he's not dissatisfied. No, he's...
Well, she's telling him. He asks his next question.
Yeah.
And I think he's not satisfied that these things are all using the word the same way. That there's that the counterparts are all really counterparts, and so I can see why you should think there should be a counterpart in the Pandit, as you were saying, samsara. And so it strikes me that when he says, when he gets to that limit, that Dhammadina is, I think, fudging. She's assuming that he's dissatisfied, or, you know, that he, because he just doesn't understand what Nibbana is, right? But I think it's because she's not using the word in the same way through it. And then, you know, she goes to the Buddha, and he confirms her interpretation. That looks to me like he thinks what's going on is this is that Visakha doesn't want to believe a woman. And so he's going to say, right, no, she's got it, she's enlightened and all that, and you're a male chauvinist.
That's not the case, because there are similar suttas that have the similar passage where it's a famous monk who gives the answers to the questions, like Mahakachana and Ananda. And then they say, if you're not satisfied with my answer, you go to the Buddha and check it out with him. And the other monks go to the Buddha, and the Buddha praises either Kachana or Ananda. And then confirms it.
In that case, then, okay, if it's not an issue of male chauvinism,
no, it's not,
then I think it's an issue of organizational structure. That is, he's saying, look, if you're not going to believe anybody but me, I'm not going to be able to handle this. There's too much for me to do to try to run a religion all by myself. You can't believe the people that I approve of. You know, forget it.
Okay, maybe if there's just one more question, we could take that. Okay, there doesn't seem to be any. Then just one question from the internet left. Just, it's a verbal question. What is the word being translated as deliverance? The word, the Pali word, is vimukti. Yeah, I don't really like the word deliverance because, you know, it has certain connotations, maybe about somebody, like a divine figure, lifting one up and saving one. So I like better liberation or release. Okay, we will have to end the class now, I think. Johnny, do we have to go to New York right away or after lunch? Or should we have a...
After discussion.
Okay, so we'll have a discussion after lunch. About a half an hour discussion. So any other points that want to be discussed, we'll discuss after lunch. And then we'll have another class next week. That's March 5th. And we'll be taking sutta number 48. That is the... the sutta at Kosambi, the Kosambi Sutta. Okay, so let us do the sharing of the merits. Chirang Rakantu Sasanam Akasa Ta Chaluma Ta Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantam Anumodipa Chirang Rakantu Desanam Akasa Ta Chaluma Ta Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantam Anumodipa Chirang Rakantu Mamparam Eta vatacha amhehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya eta vatacha amhehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya eta vatacha amhehi sampadam punya sampadam Sabbe sadanumodantu Sabba sampati siddhya Bhavagupadaya vichihetato Etantare satakai upapanna Rupiya rupicha sanya sanino dukkha pamucchantu dosantu nibbutim. Okay, we end with three bows. Three half bows.
Out of bandage.